You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today, we talked to Todd Rogers, who is the Weatherhead Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is a behavioral scientist who works to increase student attendance, strengthen democracy, and improve communication. He is the co-author of Writing for Busy Readers, Communicate More Effectively in the Real World. And he wrote that with Jessica Lasky Fink. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Todd Rogers, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Kelly.
The opening line of your book, Writing for Busy Readers, is, quote, "This is a book we never planned to write," end quote. So I'll bite. How did this book come to be?
Well, there's the practical story, and then there's the after having written it, people have, it has become clear to me why I wrote it. But we'll start with the practical story.
Yeah, give me both.
Yeah, it's not, the practical story is, and like the professional story is, well, I spent 10 years working on how do we communicate effectively to voters. I started an organization that's sort of the hub in the Democratic Party of like behavioral science and communication with voters. Then I shifted to education, did similar stuff with communicating to busy families. And then during the pandemic, started working with other leaders. And we're like, oh, there's like a commonality here that everyone is trying to break through to busy people. And everyone is busy. And no one is reading anything that we write carefully. And so that's like the, or, and we're like, oh, well, it turns out there's a science to this. And Jessica and I were like, we could pull this together. And we thought it would be useful. And so that's the practical version.
And the next one, the after you wrote it?
Well, the after one is I don't read anything that I receive, and I want to teach people to write so that I will read what they send me. I didn't even realize, like, it's complete, they say in research, they call it me-search, right?
Which
about yourself. I didn't think that was this. I thought I was helping, you know, people communicating to voters and families and customers and employees. It turns out I'm hoping that we disseminate it widely enough that people write to me in a way that's easy to skim.
All right. So I think I told you this in one of our exchanges that I really enjoyed the book. I read it on PDF, so I didn't get the full experience because it wasn't the visuals weren't all there. So I actually bought the book and gave it to a colleague because I've been talking to them about how you know smart it is. And he sent out he started reading the book. I could tell from this exchange this morning, which was in caps, I need your assistance. And then he laid out the thing, which was just give him notes on this document. And I was like, oh, I know exactly what to, when I have 10 minutes, because that's what I need to probably give notes on a one-sheeter, which I think I knew what it was. I knew exactly what to do. So I saved it for the time I had, and then I popped in and I gave him my notes. And I'm like, I don't know that I do that without the caps.
I guess. I mean, meanwhile, he's muttering to himself, I cannot believe Kelly handed me this book as a gift, like under the guise of being a gift, right? Like his,
maybe.
So, but yes, that for those just tuning in now, the book is about how to write so busy people read, understand, and respond. Mm-hmm. And that means writing in a skimmable way. I think the caps thing is interesting. Like, we, as you know, we talk about in there.
Yes.
It's different people interpret caps in different ways. Some people think you're yelling at them. Some people think that you're emphasizing something that's really important. And then some people think the third thing, which is what you like, you're just trying to draw attention to this as opposed to everything else.
Well, yeah, and I think that here's the context in which this works. It's we had a leadership offsite a week ago. This was a thing he presented. He said to us at the time, "I want to narrow it down and get your notes to like five or six of us." So I'm understand, and it was in Teams, and I understand the context of him sending it in Teams to the smaller group. He's new. So I am actually giving that space of like, I know I'm not going to assume he's yelling at me. That, and by the way, bad move if that were the early move.
Right.
So, but in your book says this all the time. There's not one right way to do this. Context is constantly shifting, but you have pretty good rules of the road.
Yeah, totally. And the all caps as the primary message is typically not one of them, but like
Yes.
what dominates all of it is context. Is like, what are our norms and how is the reader going to interpret the way I'm writing this? And so, yeah, so if caps works for you, one of the, I mean, as we talk about in the book, and I become lately kind of obsessed with this thing in the US Army called bluff, bottom line
Yeah.
up front. And the US Army has literally a regulation that this is how we write, everyone. You write with the first line is the bottom line. So if you're a general writing to an enlisted person, the first line is the bottom line. But more importantly, if you're an enlisted person writing to a general, first line's the bottom line. I say it's more important because the lower status person just has this pressure on them to like, we ran into each other in Kandahar. I admire your work so much. We actually grew up in the same town. Like so much throat clearing about admiration and respect that it just really burdens the reader and it disadvantages the writer. So like setting those norms in your context, I don't know that you had an explicit discussion about it, but like you clearly interpreted it the way you wanted, which is like, hey, please help with the thing below.
So my wife, the comedy professor, is obsessed with status because if you think about classic comedy duos, it's always a status play, and that and status, of course, in plays out in comedy all the time. So one of the things at Second City, we're constantly finding ourselves with young performers is you have to learn how to shift your status because there are people who just play low status or just play high status, and if you stay in there's no variation. It's less interesting. You're not going to surprise us. And by the way, it's the upending of the status that usually is the funny thing. And I always use Tina Fey as my example for this because Tina is a very powerful person in her industry, obviously widely admired. And if you think about almost everything that she's been involved with, like, with 30 Rock and Mean Girls and everything, she is usually playing a lower status character, even though she's the person in control. In part because you're not going to out status Alec Baldwin or Tracy Morgan or Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But she's, and Oprah is another example of someone who has all the status in the world. But if you'll notice in her shows when she's doing these interviews, she will often lower herself physically, touch a knee when someone's sort of explaining to her to give them that space of like, take the stage.
I could see that for I like I've just never thought about it from a comedy perspective, but definitely from a liking and intimacy, if like you want to like if you maintain all the appearances of being higher status, it's just like then it's hard for people to be authentic and like you in an interpersonal way and not in a deferential way. I could see that. But the comedy part is funny. I've never,
Yeah,
I,
Abbott and Costello.
yeah, huh.
All of them, Martin and Lewis. It's that is the classic sort of setup.
Yeah, it's
So,
in, yeah.
no, it's interesting too because you at the first part of this book a lot is, and I don't know that you have to do this. I think it was probably good you did, but convince people that they're busy and that the messages coming in are many. And I was just thinking about this. You've got email, chat, text, messenger, DMs, WhatsApp, phone calls, faxes, messaging me on LinkedIn, messaging me on Twitter because I don't call it X. I'm on Blue Sky now. I'm on Post, and that is too much. What's the number? Is it that the magic number is seven in terms of things that we can maybe hold in our head at one time? And so, and we're holding other things in our head, not just the messages coming in. But they're, I mean, you and I started this. When we started, right before we started taping, I saw that somehow I was getting a notification on my computer that I should not get and don't normally get. I got a new computer. So I had to go turn that off. I mean, and multitasking is not a thing.
Yeah. So a couple of directions to go on that. One, yes, when we are directing our own attention, we are willing to devote it for a shorter period of time and less intensely to any one thing before we just give up and move on to the next thing. Think about the way you manage your inbox undistracted. You're just like, it's seven paragraphs. Next.
Next.
With the false hope that you'll get back to it later. And then, but the other version is the distractedness, which is like, in addition to like, we're just unwilling to devote ourselves to something. We're also just, there's so many distractions. I love the different modes of communicating that you were talking about. It's something that, I mean, I'm sitting with right now that I think I'm going to write something about, which is like, it's much more just like dry than the rest of it. But after I teach this a lot to organizations, like how do we write to make it easier and more efficient for readers and writers? And just that makes us more effective. And it's always like, okay, so now how do we do it as an organization? It's not just how do I, Todd, become a better writer? It's how do we all become better? How do I set an organizational culture? And I think that, like, especially as we move into a world of like the future of work with a little bit more, a little more remote, a little more asynchronous, there's just a lot more writing. And I think that there are like, we need to have just explicit discussions. How do we write stylistically, structurally? Through what modes do different things get sent? Like, what gets sent on Teams? What gets sent by text? What gets sent by email? What gets sent as a report? And then we also have other questions about timing and things like that. But I just think like it's worth having an explicit discussions about these things that we just have never even bothered to have. So that's why you and I have texted and emailed.
Yeah.
And I assume one is better for you. I don't know which one's better for you.
Email is better for me for business communication. But the reason I gave you my mobile is exactly the reason we text last time, because we were supposed to tape on a Monday. I got the new computer. Zoom wouldn't work. I was like, it all happened right before we were able to text each other, you know, and you were having trouble with your computer. Classic.
Yep.
So that was a great, and that's the thing I get. Like, so I'm interviewing Renee Fleming tonight for the Chicago Humanities Festival on stage. And I have to text the guy when I'm 5 minutes away from the venue to make sure he's there to let me in, you know, at a certain point. So that's why we have that. But we've done all our business communication on email. And I don't like it when people try to do business communication with me on text, because that's my iceberg.
You know, your iceberg.
In terms of the messages, they get lost. They're more below the surface.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, totally. I'm in the same boat. I'm like, if you don't get an instant response by text, you're never getting a response. So just assume that it disappeared, that it was like lost to the void.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I wanted to ask you this question. The percentage of, if you asked a bunch of people if they considered themselves to be writers, and I'm getting you off the Harvard campus because everyone would do that there. So just regular middle America. I don't think you have more than 5% of people who would say they're writers.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think you're right. It's because it's a pretty intimidating idea.
Yeah, yeah. Except everyone is a writer.
I don't think I would call myself a writer. If you were to like cold and we weren't in the context of like me.
Oh, you wouldn't?
No, now that I honestly would, even if you asked me, running into me on the street, I probably would not remember that I'd written a book about writing for busy readers. And like, I know that I hate writing and reading and that I struggle with both. And so like, I would probably say, I don't know, but I assume you're getting to, like, it turns out we're like, everyone is writing a lot.
Yeah.
Would you say you're a writer?
I was thinking about that. I've always been a good writer. That's the sure A in school for me. When I had sure D's in math, that sort of thing. So it was very clear to me what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. But I think it probably wasn't until I wrote my book that I would feel very comfortable adding author which I think I did add on my LinkedIn, in addition to being a theatrical producer and public speaker and that sort of thing. So it's not my only hyphenate, but it's in the hyphenate now.
I'm gonna share this, even though I don't know. Jessica and I wrote a first draft of the book, and it read like an extremely readable, well-written scholarly article.
Okay.
You know, it's like, you know, in the distribution of all writing, extremely inaccessible. But in my little comparators, I'm like, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the editor and publisher are like, you know, I'm not sure this is written as if you want people to be able to read it. And we're like, yeah, you're right. So what should we do? So we actually hired like a book doctor who has written a ton of books and ghostwritten a bunch of books, written a bunch of books himself, is the editor of a popular magazine. And he just like went through it and made it look like a book. Because there's no reason I would know how to write a book, right? Like Jessica and I know the research, and we know the examples, and we know all the organizations we work with. And we reorganized it and wrote it in a completely inaccessible, probably like really brutal to read way. And then the book doctor came in and like basically just rewrote it so it looks like a book. And that really was like, and you'll never guess what happened. Right. Like I would just delete that stuff because we don't need those words.
Right.
But now it reads, I assume it reads, I read it. I liked the way it reads.
I like the way it reads as well. There's a bit of a high wire act in writing a book about writing.
Yes. Maybe I was just like self-handicapping by being like, it's not me, it's the book doctor, if you don't like it.
Yeah. No, but I think we had a very active editor when we wrote our book, and I wrote it with another person. I wrote most of it, but like Tom and I, you know, did collaborate on a lot of it and switched off things. But it was the thing I was amazed by is I thought I was being clear, and what the outside person was like, oh, be more clear if you moved this here, move that there, maybe do it. A lot of it was design.
And that's actually where I think the coolest part of writing the book was really fleshing out these examples of and so much of them. Like one of the principles is design for navigation because everyone is skimming. So basically, like you're done with your writing now. Like how do you make it navigable? Headings and indents and like the actual visual layout of it is actually pretty central to whether people are going to engage at all. And if they do engage, it helps them navigate. And like I actually been really diving into like signage lately. I've been like really obsessed with signage in the streets. Actually there's like a 15% chance that ends up being my next area of focus. We were on a trip in another country with another language, and their signage was incredible. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do on the train because the signs, and I couldn't read the language.
So you have this in the book. It's in chapter 3 where you talk about Don Norman, who wrote The Design of Everyday Things, and this idea of if a person tries to use a common object such as a door handle, a light switch, or an oven and gives up before figuring it out, that is the designer's fault. I'm obsessed by this. And I was just in Brooklyn, and we got in the elevator, and I just turned to my wife, and I'm like, Anne, what's wrong with this picture? And she's like, the light is not over the buttons. The light was over the other side, and it was so dark in the elevator, you could not see the buttons. I'm like, who decided to do this? And the entire hotel, and I'm not going to say what hotel it is, but the entire hotel was designed so poorly that it was like no outlets, and the outlets that did exist were not in useful places.
So, I mean, at least they were consistent throughout the...
They were consistent. But that's a great visual, because I'm friends with all the IDEO guys, and I don't think like that. But I think that visual idea, then applying that to your writing, makes you think about, okay, how am I lining this up? Where am I using bold? How am I underlining? You know, yes, caps might be considered bad in this area, but maybe not bad that area. And you say that's all part of your goal setting, if you know what your goal is in the writing.
Right. Yeah. You can't write effectively if you don't know what you're trying to be, what the point of the writing is, what the goal is. But the this idea, the Don Norman thing, was like from the very beginning to me, the metaphor.
Yeah.
You read If you don't understand how it works, it's the designer's fault. The radical take for the writing is, and this is like really radical, if someone looks at your writing and either gives up before understanding it or is deterred and doesn't engage at all, imagine if it was always our fault as the writer and it was never the reader's fault that they didn't read it. Like I now open when I give talks or I do workshops, I always open with this like AI generated like cartoonish thing of someone with incredulously saying, "Didn't you read the thing?"
Yeah.
Didn't you read? Like we've all had this experience, like with like disgust. I spent so much time on that. Didn't you read the thing? But imagine if it was always our fault that they didn't read the thing. That's the sort of Don Norman twist on it, which I believe.
Yeah, that's also akin to when some of the books I've read recently dissect big companies' vision and mission statements, and like this word salad that they're giving you in terms of it, none of that is useful. What is actionable in terms of your statement here? So I know what the hell it is that you believe.
Right. I mean, actually that's, I've never thought about it that way. I bet they are all written. I bet if you were to pull together the, you know, Fortune 500 mission statements, if they all have them, I don't know if they do, the average reading level required to understand them is probably college graduate or higher.
Yes. Or higher.
They're probably 30 to 50 words. They're probably like grammatically complex. So I say that as like, one of the things is you just want to make it easy to read in one pass through. And I bet that many of them require you going backwards to make sure that you understand what the subject is and the object is in reference to. Like if they're literally written to be inaccessible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I use the line, Nir Eyal turned me on this line, which is, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. So I know that's true about improvisation. I certainly know that's true about writing.
Yeah, there's the like famous New Yorker cartoon with like the devil sitting at a desk, looking at some papers, and there are these underlings around, and they're like, this document is impossible to read and technical and you know, written in a complex way. I'm very impressed. That's the idea is like one of the things we Jessica and I have sort of concluded is, if something is hard to read, either they're not a very good writer, but more likely, especially if it's a high stakes thing, is they're trying to make it hard to read.
Yeah. All right. In 2017, 22,000 people in England unknowingly agreed to 1,000 hours of community service while they were signing up for free public Wi-Fi. Now, they weren't doing that on purpose, were they?
They being the people, no. They being the people who wrote the disclosures. Yeah, and there were a few in there, right? Is there one about like people signed over their souls inadvertently?
Yes.
I have on my wall. There's no way you could see it. There's this website, Visual Capitalist, and they like visualize cool like data, and it has all these important historical documents. From the Constitution to the Book of Genesis to I can't read it, but they have all these like important works that we would all recognize. And then they like it's the length is the number of words. And then they have like Facebook's terms and conditions and Google's terms and conditions. And it like goes all the way down the whole wall. Like it's just a very narrow, long piece of paper because, they don't expect anyone to read it, which is exactly the, like, you know, that allows them to put whatever they want about how they're going to deal with their privacy.
So then you talk about this idea of like using less words. This is a big thing in comedy, which is ruthless editing to get to the joke. Because really, normally, the longer you're going, the less likely. Now, there's sometimes those like 17-minute hunks that we see that play with the little journey in here. But mostly when you're in, especially a review format like Second City, which is akin to Saturday Night Live, it's about getting to those sort of jokes. And that's usually sort of taking stuff out. You write very simply, write shorter sentences. And you also talk about the fact that novels published in 1800 averaged 27 words per sentence, whereas those published in 2000 averaged just 10 words per sentence. So we've already adapted over time.
Yeah, and the idea is that it requires effort, cognitive effort, to read longer sentences because you have to hold it all in your head at once. You were talking about 7 ± 2, just like how the capabilities of our memory. It just requires more effort to read a long sentence because in order for it to make sense, you have to hold the whole thing in your head. And so if you can shorten it and the period tells the reader the idea is over, new idea. It'll connect to the other one, but new idea. And so what we see is that people who struggle to read, which I don't know how relevant it is, but it is always important to me. The median U.S. adult, 50th percentile, one half of U.S. adults read at ninth grade reading level or lower, which means they really struggle to read long sentences. Those mission statements are totally inaccessible. And okay, so if we want to write so that more people can read it, we should write these short, accessible sentences. But also, people who can read those things, you and me and many of your listeners, are totally comfortable reading long, convoluted sentences. It's just unpleasant and requires a lot of effort. And we're going to move on to the next thing. So that's the idea. The idea is to increase accessibility for more people, but also just to to get through before people quit on you. Can I ask you? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Can I ask you? Like, I'm always wondering about in person versus writing. In writing, the switching costs are really low for the reader. The reader is like, I want to move on, so they just flip. In person, you have them captive. They may mind wander, they may eventually leave, but you have them captive. So it seems like the ruthlessness towards words is surprising because I feel like you own them in captivity there. Like they're not going to give up on you.
Well, physically.
Attention.
Yeah. If you think about it slightly differently, which is you need to get 300 people in a room to laugh at the same time. That's a different kind of math. And that math requires, and this is what a director does at Second City, which is, if you cheat your face out, if you cheat your body out this way and drop this and drop that, I think you will get the harder synchronous laugh. And we try it out. And it's because we create our content in front of an audience at Second City. So our Second City process, which is like it maps to an innovation process, 12 weeks co-creating with the audiences, all the comedy, we get suggestions from the audience, we spit it back at them. It's over and over again. So we know by the time we open a show where the laughs are. Every once in a while, you might have a dud audience or they're more smilers or nodders, whatever. But we've done it enough that we know. And it is in that editing process. And the stand-ups do the same thing. The reason Chris Rock goes to the Comedy Cellar to try out something for free is because he knows that comedy only works if the audience is laughing, and he's got to try it out. It has to be practiced.
So I get that. I never thought about the synchronizing of the laughter. That's cool. And that actually is totally right. I get that. But couldn't I just why conciseness? Why does conciseness matter if you're setting it
for a laugh? Set,
yeah, why
it's, is it's math. It's comedy math. There's a thing called the rule of three. Things are not funny if they're two. They're less funny if they're four. They're funny if they're three. Bada 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 bada. And then they're funny if they're six. And they're funny if they're nine. So there's a lot of mathematician thinking that goes on, within comedy. There's also getting deep in the weeds. My wife's theory of comedy is that it's like a mixing board, and you're working with recognition, some level of pain, and some level of distance. So and at any given time, it's that mix that is happening. So and distance can mean many different things for many different people. The example I use in actually my book is 4 years after Columbine, we're doing a scene at a school with a shooting gone bad, comedic scene, and this woman jumps up and screams and leaves in tears. And it turns out she had been a freshman at Columbine when that happened. For her, there was never going to be enough distance.
Right.
But everyone else, especially in Chicago, 4 years later, And, you know, explaining that to someone at that time when they're paying is not the point, and that wasn't what we tried to do. But it is it is a reality. So, and so different levels of pain, different levels of recognition, and how you feel it, and that distance. So, you know, this sort of mix that you're constantly working with. I guess an orchestra could be like that way. With the different instruments need to come together in a different sort of way, and you can only go atonal for so long. Because that's the other thing about a Second City show. It's like vaudeville. It's a review. So it's the order that the scenes are in and what you want the audience to experience at different points is very specific.
See, I get it. You're not saying communicate the idea in the fewest number of words. You're saying the fewest number of words necessary to achieve the comedic goal. And that's, and so the comedic goal can have extra words or phrases that fit the rhythm of it and and the right. Okay, so for me, like, we're like, use fewer words because your goal is conveying some idea, and you and the idea I understand prior to this conversation an idea. Your goal is not an idea so much as an idea crossed with the comedy that comes that it carries with it or something.
A laugh. And an important, like for us, it's a smart laugh.
Okay, got it. Yeah, no, I get it. Okay, so that makes sense. So from use fewer words, meaning omit needless words, the way anyone who's read this famous book, Strunk and White, wrote The Elements of Style, mm-hmm. and one of their famous chapters is called Omit Needless Words. Yes, cheap, easy. Instead of saying in order to, you can just say to. And then you just cut two words and lost nothing. That's easy. The like more subtle ones are omit only kind of useful ideas, because the more things you add, the more likely someone is to give up on you. And so there's just trade-offs. Like, you just have to decide what's in and what's out. And like, it's kind of like when you're writing a joke, like the goal is not nothing. The goal is not just the punchline. The goal is
And if you do the similar thing, you're right. Like, if you introduce a whole other idea that takes away from the original idea, which is what you're trying to do the joke on, you're trying to accomplish two jokes and one. No, don't do that. You can move out on. Yeah, it's fascinating. I want to talk to you about Elizabeth Lewis Newton's work at Stafford around tappers and listeners, because I have my own story that involves Nick Epley from the University of Chicago. So explain this in the context of the book, and I'll tell you my thing.
It is called The Curse of Knowledge in Social Psychology. It's incredible and it's super robust. The idea is when you know something, you can't unknow it. And she does in her dissertation, Elizabeth does, where she tells me, Todd, tap happy birthday on the table. And I go,
mm-hmm.
And then they have someone sitting across the table and they're like, what song did she tap? Did, in this case, Todd tap? And they'll ask me, what's the odds that you, Kelly, are going to detect what song I just tapped? And I'm like 95%. Like, it's obvious. I think the stat was like 3% or like 5% of people ever got it, because you just can't unknow. It's obvious to me when I'm tapping it. Happy birthday to you. It's obvious. But so the curse of knowledge is you can't really unknow something. And so when you're trying to imagine what someone else is subjectively experiencing, you cannot, it's impossible to let go of what you know. You can try, but it's like a really hard effort, activity.
So when we were starting to collaborate with the University of Chicago on a program that became the Second Science Project, Nick Epley visited Anne's class here at Second City. It was her comedy studies class. These are college kids. And she's like, just come in and watch. And if you have questions or you want to pop in, whatever. So she was doing a gibberish game. And so this particular gibberish game, it was three people. The person in the center was the translator. And the other two were going to speak in their own form of gibberish. And the translator would just say, they'd make up what they thought the person said and say it to the other person. And then they'd go back. And so they do this thing, and it's very funny, because the person in the middle, if they're witty, and this woman was very witty, was finding ways to make this gibberish very funny. And then Nick's like, can I ask a question? And then he's like, how much do you think you knew what the other person was saying? And they're like, oh, I got the gist of what they were saying. And then they're like, what were you saying? And it was nothing. It was nothing. And it was very specifically tied to this study. Like, you know, you think you do, curse of knowledge.
Totally. Once you know it, you can't unknow it. And one of the ways that it has since applied to this kind of approach to writing, which is this is me back to the writing for busy readers, is people have started saying you can't unsee it. Once you see that, in addition to being more effective to write to make it easier to skim, it's also unkind to your reader to write in a way that makes it hard to read. And you can't unsee it. So now people like tell me that they don't like that they're now judging everyone that emails them as being like, why do you not respect my time? How dare you send me just a 6-paragraph message when the real gist of it is, should we meet tomorrow? You can't unsee it in the same way you can't unknow it. But I love the gibberish thing because that wasn't even part of your thing. It was just funny to convey gibberishness. But the people just sort of like, oh, I see you, Kelly. I got you. You're really talking about what's for dinner tonight.
So what's interesting about that, in that instance, certainly it was not about that, but the origin of that game or that exercise, whatever you want to call it, was created by Viola Spolin in the 20s and 30s at Jane Addams Hull House, because she was a social worker and her job was to better assimilate immigrant children and neighborhood children into her care. So she created a lot of these exercises in gibberish or in silence so the kids could practice communication. Huh. Empathy, connection. She was big on stage picture. So when kids would be playing these games and she would yell at, out like stage picture, so everyone would know to move in a balance. So it's like little kids playing soccer where they're all going with the ball. It's like, no, like you need to use the whole field, you use all the space with that. And that was something she was also teaching, because her whole deal was using arts and play as social work for young people. And so that that's why so much of our work has evolved over the years into working with people with social anxiety, people with Parkinson's, people in the, all these different areas, because it's about practicing recognizable human behavior.
I want to play the gibberish game.
Yeah, no, it's fun. Okay, I'm going to ask you in a moment for a yes and story, but one of the things I want you to talk about is that New York Police Department court summons notification story. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I love it. It's research that this team at Ideas 42, in fact, led by Alyssa Fishbane and with Anu Shah at Chicago. The context is, every year, let's say 500,000 people in New York City are arrested and then they are discharged with a piece of paper that is a court summons. And the piece of paper is written in a way that just transfers all the key information in it, but it's not written at all to be easy to read. And the presumption is that someone who is discharged is the only thing they're handed. They must read it carefully because it's super important. They were just discharged after an arrest. And what the point of the document is to tell people they need to show up to a specific court on a specific day at a specific time. Half of people do not show up. Mm-hmm. And for all of those who fail to appear, they get issued a bench warrant, which means they get almost everybody gets issued this bench warrant, means that the police are going to arrest you next time you encounter them because you failed to show up to court. The presumption was that they read it. This Ideas 42 team, led by Alyssa and Anuj, they rewrote it as if the goal was to make it easy to read. So they labeled it a criminal court appearance ticket, and they just restructured it. So it was just a busy person. And this is like the most, you just got discharged. It's a very important document. A busy person can quickly pull out, I need to show up to court at a specific day and a specific time. And they ran a study with the New York City Police Department. And it was like incredibly much more effective, with like to everyone's surprise. The judges, the lawyers, the police officers, everyone was surprised that, wait, the reason people are not showing up to court is not because they're trying to avoid the court. They're not criminals trying to avoid the court. They just didn't understand this really important form that we give everybody.
Wow. I mean, of course, because like I just had to transfer some money from Wells Fargo. I can tell you that experience of the paperwork was a nightmare. And on purpose. And then there's other situations where the tollway now is like you know, all automated. And I just got a letter the other day. Hey, here's what you owe in the $12 you owe in tolls. And I'm like, this is great. Went right to the website, paid it off. It's like, everyone wins. You get your money. And I got to where I got quicker because I didn't have to wait in line. So it feels like there's certain segments of society where they're like embracing this and others that just won't.
Yeah. And I think when the action they're trying to get is for you to pay them, they've started to adopt this pretty quickly because it's yeah, demonstrably better.
Yes.
I mean, the TLDR of the whole like approach, which in our case, we're focused on writing, but in all other forms of communication and probably let's say most things is if we make it easy for people, they'll be more likely to do it. In this case, if you make it easy to read, people are more likely to read it. It's also kinder to them because you are showing them, like you're just saving them time. So it's the TLDR is we should add a round of editing to everything we write where we ask ourselves, how do I make it easier for the reader? It's more effective, it's kinder, and it's more accessible. But it's probably true across all categories. But here we're just talking about the way we write.
Did we discuss this fairly recent study that Vanessa Bonds was involved with around scripts and saying no?
No. Tell me about it. I love her work, though. She's actually done a bunch on writing.
Yeah, emails.
And stuff. Yeah.
So as the guy who wrote Yes And, I am very interested in No. And this particular study, they split it up to a group. So half of the group, they're under a room and the person said, hey, I need you to unlock your phone, hand it to me. I'm going to take it outside to do some stuff. If you don't want me to do that, you don't have to, and it won't affect your pay. And that was one. And the second group was same deal. We're going to take your phone. We're going to move it out. However, they said, if you don't want us to do this, say, doctor, I don't want you to do this. That group said no. The other group just let them screw with their phones. And the idea that I got out of that, which is, oh, if you're talking about boundaries and they're important to you want someone to know that they've got boundaries, give them a script. And I did this in an email recently with someone who I knew pretty well, but not well enough, perhaps to be making the request I was making. And I said to them, at the end of it, I go, if you don't want to make this introduction, just say, Kelly, I'd rather not. It's totally cool. And in this case, she was like, yeah, no, I'm happy to make the introduction.
I love that. Although I think I flirted with this a couple of times in messages, but I realized that when I give the script, if they give it directly back to me, there needs to be some kind of like jokiness or something to it because if it's like Kelly, I'd love, if you're willing, please take a plane, come here. I'd like to show you this signed book I have here. But if you don't want to just say, Todd, no, thank you. I'm busy. It's just sort of a weird, for you to just reply as if it was Microsoft Office, giving you the proposed words for you to finish. I don't know, but maybe it licenses people. It definitely licenses people, but
was a live communication. It was a live communication, not a written.
I wonder if you actually made it in like a funny decline. Then they could be
I made a joke. I made a joke about it with this, the thing that I'm referring to, which was a written communication. But again, this was with someone who's funny. It's a person who works here. So I did make a joke and then they made a joke in their response to me.
Yeah, I think that could work. That I like. If they just take my script, no, thank you, Todd.
Yeah.
Even when I just said, I feel like it feels somehow potentially offensive. That's like one of the things you need to know your audience. I mean, across all of these.
Let's email Vanessa because there's a small sample. I want to do more with this. I think it's a really interesting idea of scripted boundaries versus improvisation, which is about creating safe spaces where people can make something out of nothing and understanding that that's messy and that there's going to be mistakes and we're all kind of in it and we understand what those norms are. And then in these other situations when there needs to be certain kinds of boundaries, and there I know this in intimacy training, there's a lot of use of signals and words to just stop the action, not to necessarily to judge, but to just like stop.
Yeah, I think all of this, you're partly, this is you riffing on, if we make it easy, people are more likely to do something. I One of the things that I was involved in was a company where they were trying to get current customers to refer other customers, you know, the sort of viral or what is it like word of mouth marketing. And like it felt like the big breakthrough was giving a script for them to make it easier for the current customers. Be like, you know, and this was a kind of a financial services thing. And so I was like, look, here is a sentence that you can say that maybe these guys are great at this if you would like to learn. Because otherwise you're asking them to do the work of summarizing what you do and they whatever. So it, similar, like I guess across all these things, if we want people to be likely to do it, in this case, yours was like boundary setting. It's a pretty generous act for you making a request. Also embedded in the request is make it really easy for you to say no. We all do this when we feel like we're asking for too much, but it's pretty generous kindness.
I did that because I am cognizant of my status as related to this individual. So she's an actress. She's an actress in my wife's touring company, and we're friendly, but I don't know her that well. But she knows who I am and what I do here, and aware that I know who she is. And I didn't want her to feel like, because I don't know that this, like, she knew someone I wanted to be in touch with. And I didn't know if that was going to make her uncomfortable. And I'm very aware of all that. And I could probably get to this person another way. So yeah, it's again, all of this to say is summing up context. Do you have time for telling us a yes and story?
Let's do it. Yeah. I got invited to give a talk about this work to with and work with the government in United Arab Emirates. And it's a long trip and I have kids. I normally would not say yes, but then I was like, well, can my kids are in school, but can my wife join? And it's more like a negotiation than a yes and, but she ended up joining. It ended up being just an amazing trip. I love my children too, but when it was just the two of us, it was just an unbelievable that there. And that was where I was talking about signage. Like the signage there is unreal. But the more interesting thing was, I guess if we're saying yes and, it was like yes and can I bring my wife?
Yeah, well, you just like that. That's exactly what a yes and, which is like, well, I want to, I don't know if I want to do this, but and if I can add this, would this make it? And then that gives them, you just give them a script to say yes in some regards to that. I love it. The book is called Writing for Busy Readers: Communicate More Effectively in the Real World. You wrote it with Jessica Lasky Fink. Todd Rogers, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.